Welcome to Wabanaki Windows. I'm Donna Loring. Today's show is dedicated to the memory and legacy of Penobscot Nation tribal elder Reuben Butch Phillips. Here is his granddaughter, Sage, to tell us a little bit about him, and then we will air the interview we had with him a while ago about canoes. Sage?
I'm honored to be here to celebrate my grandfather, Butch Phillips. He was undeniably proud of his Penobscot people, so proud that he dedicated his entire life to serving the Penobscot Nation in many ways that ensured the heartbeat of our people would keep going throughout the generations. In our final moment together, he said to me, "Sage, make sure everyone knows who I am. Tell everyone that I am so proud to be born Penobscot. I am so proud to be truly Indigenous." Grampy served on the Passamaquoddy Penobscot Land Claims Negotiating Committee, was the first chairman of the Tribal Fish and Game Committee, a role in which he served in for 15 years. He was the chairman of Wabanaki Confederacy Conference, a member of the Tribal Dam Relicensing Committee. He also served as director, Northeast Region, Native American Fish and Wildlife Association for 6 years, and was the co-chair of Penobscot River Ambassadors. He conducted many traditional ceremonies, including the historic removal of the Great Works and Beezy Dams and the opening ceremonies for the National Whitewater Canoe Championships held in Old Town. He built several birch bark canoes, many, many moose calls and baskets, and some of his fondest memories were created when he pulled up a chair to drum with the Bunnewapskeag Singers. My grandfather was my best friend, and I certainly have him to thank for my connection to my culture. He has given me incredible amounts of knowledge that I will hold close with me forever. My grandfather was a storyteller. To me, his purpose on this earth was to share his knowledge about our people, culture, and traditions to help others learn. He is a man who took the time to teach everyone around him our traditions, not just for you to know, but so that you now have the gift of a story about our people, cultures, and traditions that you could pass on. I'll close by saying that I often reflect on the path that his moccasins have not only walked, but helped create, and that we as a people must step up and carry on his legacy. As my cousin Mullion reminded me and guided me, as she so often does, he's not gone, it's just different now. The path he left us is clear and wide, and while we have some big steps to follow, we will succeed. K'chiwiliuni to everyone who is up for the challenge. They are some big shoes to fill, but he will be with us every step of the way.
Butch, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here, Donna.
Good to have you. Let's talk about some history. I know you're good at that, so.
Well, it's interesting, the history of the origin of the birch bark canoe. Archaeologists tell us that, after the glaciers receded about 9,000 years ago, the state of Maine, which is now the state of Maine, in this locality in the northeast, was mostly tundra, and a perfect environment for growing of the necessities, material for the birch bark canoe, namely the white birch, the black spruce, and the cedar. And although we can't put a definite date on the origin of the canoe or who actually made the first birch bark canoes, we as the Wabanaki believe that the origin was up here in the northeast. Some of the southern tribes had the dugout canoes. However, in this area, we also had dugout canoes, but they were used mostly in the estuaries of the St. John and the St. Lawrence River, used mostly in the ocean. Whereas the dugout canoe was heavy, it was not practical for use in our rivers, the Penobscot, the St. Croix, the Kennebec, and so forth, because of the many rapids and the long carries around the rapids, which made the use of the dugout canoe very impractical. The birch bark canoe, in contrast, is lightweight, and it can carry a lot of dunnage and wongan, as we call it, and can be carried around the various rapids and falls. And it is made entirely from materials gathered in the forest. The bark of the birch, the white birch, is used, and the white cedar is used for the wood the interior of the canoe, and the ash or birch is made for the cross members called the thwarts. And it is all tied together by using the roots of the black spruce tree. And also the waterproofing is made using either pine pitch or spruce pitch, put on the seams, which are sewn by using black spruce root again for waterproofing. The Penobscots called their canoe a queedon, which literally means floats lightly. And it is very fast compared to the European boat, which is very heavy. And when the Europeans first came here, they marveled at the vessel, the birch bark canoe, which could carry a large amount of gear and people, and yet is very fast compared to their boat, which was rowed. And another advantage of the canoe is that it can be driven by one paddler or a pole, poling upstream, and you're facing in the direction of your travel, so you can read the rapids, read the water ahead of you. So it's very, very interesting. The construction of the birch bark canoe, as I mentioned, is made from all materials gathered in the forest. Now, one could make a birch bark canoe by having only an axe, a knife, and an awl. And with that axe, you gather the birch bark and the spruce root and so forth. And the construction, the modern-day construction, is exactly the same as our ancestors did. We do use some modern metal tools, and the crooked knife, which is a metal knife, some people say there was actually an invention of the French people in Canada, but that's the tool that you use for the construction of all the wooden materials in the canoe. And I've been asked a number of times about the birch bark canoes. Why is it brown? And the white birch is naturally white. Well, the white is inside. And the more smooth brown layer of the bark is on the outside, because you want the smoothness of the bark. You don't want the roughness of the bark to impede your progress. And also, if you have a crack in the bark, you can see it from the brown side. And also, the white birch, the white birch can be sewn without being torn to extend the length of the canoe. So there's a lot of advantage of the white birch. The black spruce, the reason we use the spruce tree is because the spruce root grows parallel to the top of the ground. It doesn't grow down like other trees, so it's very easy to harvest. And when you use it to sew the canoe, everything is wet, and when it hardens, it's there, and it can last 100 years as long as it's not damaged.
Yeah. Well, James, you there?
I am here.
Do you have anything to add to the history piece of the use of the canoe?
Well, for me, it's, I'm a historian, but I'm also a geographer, and understanding the landscape is really important to me, and I can't get beyond how vitally important birch bark canoe was to our cultural ways. For the large number of Wabanaki people that were here living on these watersheds that kind of feed the Gulf of Maine, we as a people couldn't survive living all in one place year-round. Sure, you could do that on the coast in the summertime. There was enough food sources there. But when it came to hunting season, we'd break up into kinship groups, our families, and move inland to prescribed hunting territories, territories that kind of got passed down through the families generation after generation. And you would always return to those places where you knew where the best hunting was, you know, where all the berries were. And you're preparing for winter. And you would winter over with your family. And then in the spring, you'd make your way, you know, back out into heading towards the coast, stopping at falls to do some fishing and collecting that. So, you know, we had a very sophisticated kind of seasonal migration going on here. And with the boreal forest that's here in the north, the easiest way to travel is by water, using the rivers, streams, lakes, and ponds as the roadway. And the birch bark canoe, the vehicle that could get you there. And
now you mentioned the boreal forest.
Yeah.
Explain that to me.
Well, aside from, like, in southern New England, they had a hardwood forest and, you know, big tall trees with canopies that were quite separate from the undergrowth. And Native Americans there would burn twice a year, one for ease of travel. We don't have that opportunity, but really, you know, a lot of conifers that go right to the ground, that burning large tracts of forest here just creates a forest fire. You know, where in southern New England, could burn the undergrowth without lighting the canopy on fire. So a very dense type of forest, not easily to travel through, you know, a lot of bogs, a lot of, you know, those type of swampy areas also.
So if you have a birch bark canoe, mm-hmm, and you're going through these swampy bogs,
well, you wouldn't need to go through. Well, no, as Butch mentioned, Gweedon is the Penobscot word for...
Yeah, but what's light? You compare a canoe, a birch bark, to an aluminum. I mean, not saying they had aluminum back then, but I'm trying to, you know, figure out that heavy.
Well, basically, if you take the birch bark canoe and a modern wood canvas canoe, a fiberglass canoe, or aluminum canoe, they all weigh about the same, 80 to 85 pounds. A 14 or 15 foot canoe is going to weigh 60 pounds, right? But as far as speed is concerned and maneuverability, you can't compare a birchback canoe to an aluminum canoe, for instance, because the birchback canoe is much more maneuverable and
so
faster.
So, what's the average length of a birchbark? Let's say average, a good length.
18.
Well, there were three types of canoes.
Yeah.
There was the ocean going canoe, which was 18 to 22 feet, let's say, and much broader and deeper. And then the river canoe, which we are famous for, was normally 16 to 18 feet, and that was enough to carry your family and your all your gear and your bark for the wigwam and so forth. And then there was the what they call the hunting canoe, which was, 11 to 14 foot, which was small and wide, and that was used more that you'd leave on a pond or a place where you would frequent hunting, but it wasn't for long distance travel or carrying a lot of
interesting
gear.
I didn't know that.
So you know, the very important thing about it being lightweight is very easy to heft over your head and carry through the woods, which is a very important cultural concept, because it wasn't just about paddling in one river. You can travel the Sowadabscook and Hamden to the headwaters of that stream, take a quarter mile walk through the woods with your canoe over your head, and put it into a pond that is in the headwaters of the Sebasticook. And if you follow that down, you're in the Kennebec River. So the 75-mile journey from river to river was a shortcut. But these portages are all over the place. They link places like Moosehead Lake to the West Branch. They link the East Branch to the Aroostook River. They link the West Branch to the Allegash. Mattawamkeag River, which I call the Highway East, you know, linked us to places like the Machias Rivers, the Union Rivers, as well as the Aroostook and the St. John.
So there's lots of rivers and ponds.
Yes.
In me. You see that, you know, if you're flying in and mm-hmm. you look, and that's all you see is like rivers and ponds. And so, yeah.
And if you look at the ancient place names, they tell us a lot about kind of what's going on in certain places. You know, Hermann Fond, for instance, is the literal translation means a place where you have to make a decision. And when you get to Hermann Pond, you either turn right and go towards the Kanduskeg, or you go left as you travel across to the Kennebec.
Huh. You can kind of, that's sort of like a synergy of what's going on today, huh? Okay. All right. So when you decide you're going to make a canoe, what's the first thing you do? I mean, let's back up. What's the best time of year to find a birch bark or to start making a birch bark?
Well, normally it's in the summer because the bark comes off the tree much easier. It doesn't stick to the tree like it would in the wintertime. However, there are two different types of bark that we call the summer bark and the winter bark. The only difference is that the winter bark has a dark brown rind on it. And if you wet that rind and scrape away the rind with a knife, you can leave etching on there and make designs of the Penobscot designs, animals, and so on and so forth. And the summer bark is much lighter, almost yellow, but the thickness may be the same, but there is numerous differences in the types of bark. So when you're looking at a tree the bark that's quality for a canoe, it has to be thick, number one. It can't split because the layers have a tendency to split. And also, it must be very flexible and what we call horizontal eyes. Those horizontal eyes will split when you go to bend them.
Yeah. Now, you know, the environmentalists or whatever are going to ask you, is this process going to kill the tree?
Well, when I take the bark to build a birch bark canoe, I cut the tree down, okay, and then take the bark off. It's much, much easier, naturally, that
so
kills
I guess
the tree.
So it does kill the tree.
However, you can take the bark off a tree by using a ladder or putting spikes in the tree to climb it and take the bark off that way. And if you don't damage the cambium, which is the next layer under the...
Which is a darker layer.
Yes, and it's thicker, then that tree will live. And the gatherers who take the bark off at safe baskets, and I take it off for making moose calls. You take it off in sections. I take 40-inch sections. And that does not kill the tree. And I can show you trees up on our islands that I know bark has been taken off 60, 70 years ago, and that tree's still living.
Wow.
And I've taken bark off in trees myself that are still living. However, if you damage the cambium, the inner layer, then it has a tendency to really damage a tree and can kill it. But in ease of gathering the bark for a canoe, I always cut the tree down.
I have no comment on that. Okay, so birch bark is really, it's very usable in not only canoes, but it has other uses, right?
Oh, yeah, it was very versatile.
What did we use them for?
Well, wigwam housing is made out of birch bark panels. It could make a ladle. We have a birch bark container called a si habajo in the language, and that's actually a birch bark container that's watertight, and you can actually boil water in it.
Wow.
So a lot of different, not just those type of vessels, but wider, large dish type of gathering baskets to gather berries, very shallow but very wide. So there's a whole host of torches also.
Maps. Yeah, and they gathered maple syrup in a bark vessel. As I mentioned, I make moose calls for our hunters out of birch bark, which is traditional. And our craftspeople make baskets, fancy baskets out of a birch bark that are etched. I make small baskets. I make birch waste paper baskets, medicine baskets, and all kinds of things out of birch. And because you can use it for decorative, you know, jewelry, hats, capes, all kinds of things. Very, very versatile. Mm-hmm. I've been caught out in the forest gathering bark and in a thunderstorm and pouring down rain, and so I took a piece of my bark and sat under it, you know, until the storm. So it's another use of it.
Oh, interesting. In some stories, I don't know if this is how true this is, but evidently there used to be like these, when it got really dry, there used to be like lightning strikes, which would start a forest on fire. And tell me if this is true, that people would take their canoes and go into the water and get under them and be safe.
You mean get under the canoe?
Yeah.
Oh, I slept under the canoe many times when I was a kid.
In the water, I mean, to get away from the fire.
They
turn the canoe upside down in the water and get under there for the... Would that work with a birch bark canoe?
I don't see why not. I'd never heard that story, but...
No, yeah. I haven't either. Yeah. I think it would.
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah,
but
it was some kind of book I was
reading. For shelter, you know, when you get ready to go to bed at night, turn the canoe over and crawl under it. I've done that when I was a kid many times.
Huh.
I have heard that they would sink the birch bark canoe to the bottom of a lake to store it for the winter.
Yes, oh yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. There was two ways of storing it. One was, like you said, James, sinking it in the water, and also turn it upside down off the ground so that the porcupines don't get it, and put a shelter over it made of sticks and boughs to keep the snow from crushing it, and then just, you know, uncover it in the spring.
Well, you'd think that if it was sunken in the water and after the ice leaves or whatever, that it would be like misshapen or something.
No, it would preserve it. And when you build a birch bark, and everything is wet, the bark is wet, the cedar is wet, the spruce root is wet.
So you. In these different steps that you do, you like take hot water and pour that over different, like the strings or the roots or whatever to make them pliable. You put that in a...
Well, you soak everything first.
Soak them, okay.
Right, like the birch bark. The roll of birch bark is sunk in the river for about 2 days. And then when you unroll it, you put hot water in it just so it won't break or crack. Okay. And the spruce root is because it's wet. And the cedar, the ribs, you actually boil them or steam them. And you bend them by hand. And that's all done by eye before you put them in.
Huh.
The gunnels are put on wet. And because you've got different bends in the gunnels. You got it not only going around a slight curve, but it's elevated as well at the ends. So that has to be wet. That has to be heated so it doesn't break. So everything is done wet. So sinking it in the river or a bog over the winter won't bother it at all.
Shape it or anything?
No.
No? Okay. So in the process of making this canoe, you take the sheets of birch bark, right? Big ones, and you lay them out?
One sheet,
not more than one.
Well, I've built two canoes myself, and I've worked on a number of other canoes. The two I built was one piece of bark, a 14-footer and for an 18-footer, all right? If the bark is not wide enough, the diameter of the tree, let's say it's 15 inches, that's not going to be wide enough in the middle of the canoe. So, therefore, you've got to sew on a panel on each side to make it wide enough in the middle. It's always going to be wide enough at the ends because you're pulling it together. So that's the only time you use another piece of bark. And if you're lucky, you can get a tree big enough that you can make the canoe out of a single piece of bark. And I know where there's several trees that are in the 22-inch diameter range that is very suitable for a...
I didn't think they had those bigger trees anymore.
They're very scarce. And yeah. I'm fortunate to know where there's, because I cruise an awful lot in the woods looking for them, you know, especially early in the spring, just after the snow is out. And but they're very hard to find. Good quality bark is becoming very rare.
Yeah. Jim? Amina?
Yeah.
James, do you have anything to add?
Sure. You know, when I really think about the birch bark canoe and its role and, you know, understanding this kind of sense of place, think about, there was a cultural geographer who said that, you know, space plus culture equals place. So you can kind of pull the culture out of that and supplant it with, you know, today we got a Maine Western kind of sense of place here in Maine. But you can take that cultural piece and you can replace it with Penobscot culture, and you start to take the same Penobscot River Valley and you start to see it differently. Start looking at the canoe routes and understanding the role of the canoe, you know, within that. And one thing that always really amazed me was the role of the beaver in our ability to canoe large distances, because it was those beavers that would make that stream that is uncanoeable highly canoeable by building dam after dam, creating these chain of ponds, they're called. And you can get way inland to a, you know, fishing spot or, you know, a hunting place. And, you know, just by what the beavers have done.
Well,
you know, I often marvel at how long it took for our ancestors to perfect a certain part of the canoe or the canoe itself. You take the birch bark canoe, you cannot improve on that canoe unless you use nails or glue or some synthetic covering. The birch bark canoe, like I said, is made all of natural materials. And when I'm working, while I'm gathering the materials or working on the canoe, I marvel at the ingenuity of our ancestors and how long it took to perfect a certain portion of that canoe. For instance, what we call the stem piece, the piece that shapes the bow and the stern, that curvature. You take a piece of cedar 3 foot long and you split it lengthwise 8 times, or at least 8 times, and then you because it's heated, wet, and you bend it, and you wrap the inner bark of the basswood tree around it to hold its shape. Well, why the inner bark of the basswood tree? Well, when you're sewing the ends of the canoe to make it waterproof, you actually put the spruce root directly through those laminations. First, you drive either your knife or an awl in there to make the hole. And you put the inner bark of the basswood tree through that, and you wrap it. And if you were to use a spruce root, let's say, for instance, you put the awl or the knife in there, it would break. The basswood tree, the inner bark of the basswood tree is such that you put a knife through it, it just separates, and it closes right back up again. It won't break. So how long did it take our ancestors on a hit-and-miss basis to come up with that's the right way to do it, the best way to do it, and we still do it today? You can't improve on it. It really, I marvel
at
it.
Do all of the, like, say the Algonquian or the other tribes that do birch bark canoes, do they all use basswood for that, or does it vary?
I'm not sure.
You don't know?
I'm not sure. They all use spruce root. Some wrap the entire gunwale with spruce root. We wrap, we have a space, let's say 3 inches between each segment of spruce root wraps, which is different. And it's just up to the builder in that particular tribe on building your canoe, the shape of it, and so forth. And you can readily tell the difference between a Penobscot or Maliseet canoe from a Mi'kmaq canoe.
What's the difference?
Well, the Mi'kmaq canoe is low, rounded ends, but what is most distinguishable is in the middle, there's a hump right in the middle, the midship, and is believed to, because they use them in the ocean, in their big rivers, and when you're pulling a fish in, let's say a big fish, a porpoise something, and your canoe has a tendency to tip, those high midships keeps it from taking in water. And so it's very distinguishable between our canoes.
Wow.
You know, what I find amazing, and, you know, this, I think the Wabanaki communities for the last 20 years or so have been in this kind of birch bark canoe revitalization. And I know the Penobscots have had 4 classes where Wabanaki people have come in to learn how to build these. And there's a lot of trickle down from that. You know, Butch talks about the 2 that he made. But he it was a part of those 4 in the community also. And for me, it's amazing to see these on the water. You know, these are beautiful crafts, and for a guy who works in museums and always see the, you know, the old ones that probably will never see the water again, it's great to see this, you know, this traditional craft take to the water. It's just amazing, you know, to be able to paddle that. And, you know, I had the honor of paddling, this is back in 2004, a birch bark canoe at dawn in the Potomac River for the grand opening of the National Museum for the American Indian.
Wow.
So they asked the people of the Dawn to, you know, open that ceremony, and we did that by paddling a brand new birch bark canoe in the Potomac.
Where's that canoe now?
That canoe usually hangs in the library of the Indian Island School. That canoe, but today it's in Center Court at the Bangor Mall on display for people to go see.
There's a important cultural aspect in building of and use of the birch bark canoe. For instance, when I took my boys out to harvest the bark for our canoe, I told them, first of all, about the importance of that particular tree. And when we felled the tree and took the bark off of it and rolled it up and get ready to carry it out, I took out a pouch of tobacco and some of our medicines and had each one of them to put the bark on the fallen tree, first of all, and then on the bark, and, you know, thanking the creator and thanking the tree for the bark. And then when we started building the canoe, we unrolled the bark, getting ready to start the construction. We again sprinkled tobacco and our medicines on the bark, and again given thanks. And then when the canoe was completely completed, and then we were going to launch it, you know, said a little prayer, and again put the tobacco in the canoe, again thanking the creator and thanking the Mother Earth for providing all the materials. When we built the first canoe on Indian Island, the first one in 60 years, the next day after we launched it, we paddled that to Katahdin, up the Penobscot as far as Pockwockamus Falls, which is about 85 miles. And when my son and I were carrying the canoe, the birch bark canoe, over the Deepskineek carry. Now, that carry's been used for thousands of years. And countless generations have carried canoes up and down that carry. And when we are carrying that canoe halfway up the carry, I mentioned to my son, I said, let's put the canoe down and just lay down here. And we are actually walking in the same footsteps that our ancestors carried the canoes up and down this carry, you know, thousands of years. And there was a very strong connection there to our ancestors, because we were doing the same thing. And carrying that canoe up the over the falls, by the falls, upriver, was probably the first time in over 100 years that anybody had carried it up the river. There had been, you know, numerous people coming down the river. But it was quite significant that we were making our way to Katahdin in a birchback canoe.
Well, powerful stuff.
It was.
Yeah. Okay. So, James?
Yes, Donna.
Comments? You were talking a little bit about Thoreau, about something that Thoreau said.
Yeah, you know, there's... So Thoreau comes here to Maine in 1846, 1853, and 1857. And in his trips in 53 and 57, he hired Penobscot guides. And the first one was Joe Attian, and they made their way to Greenville on stagecoach, and the canoe, birch bark canoe, was strapped onto the stagecoach. And in 53, they put the canoe on the steamer, like the Katahdin that's up there now Greenville, and they rowed that all the way to Northeast Carry, and then took the canoe off of that boat and made their way across the carry. But with Joe Polis in 57, he had Joe paddle the length of Moosehead Lake. And
Thoreau, how big is that lake?
Oh, God.
40 miles.
40 miles. Yeah, 40 wow. miles.
It's, okay. It's quite significant. And so Thoreau wrote about paddling the length of Moosehead Lake with poles. And he said, "Think of our little eggshell of a canoe tossing across that great lake, a mere black speck to an eagle soaring above it." So, I mean, that's kind of in Thoreau kind of poetic way. But, you know, he calls it a little eggshell of a canoe, which I think is kind of a misnomer.
Yeah, you know, most people who write about the birchback canoe always call it a fragile craft. And
because they equate it with paper or something.
I think so, yeah, because it's a paper birch, right? Yeah. But, you know, the birchback canoe can take quite a hit on a rock or you know, a scratch or whatever. And it is sewn together with spruce root on the seams, but that bark is quite tough. And probably it would take as much damage as a canvas canoe if you scraped it on a rock. But the beauty of the birch bark canoe, if you do damage the bark, you take it ashore, turn it over, and you light a piece of birch bark and you heat it up, so heat up the crack or the seam to dry it, and then put new pitch on it, and you're on your way. And when I was a kid, if you had a crack or a rip in a canvas canoe, we always used to put a piece of cheesecloth or cloth and then cover it with shellac and then wait for it to dry. Right. But the pitch dries almost immediately, so you can proceed. And every canoe.
Where do you get the pitch?
I was just going to say, every canoe had a bucket or a birch bark container with pitch all prepared in it.
Wow.
And mentioning the pitch, you don't use the pitch right directly off the tree. You have to treat it first. You can use it directly off the tree, but you don't want it to run when it gets hot, and you don't want it to be brittle when it gets cold. Therefore, you mix it with animal fat. I save the fat off the moose that I harvest every year, and I render it, and I mix that with the pine pitch or spruce pitch and a little bit of wood ash, and it must pass two crucial tests before the pitch is ready, so that it doesn't crack when it's cold or it doesn't run when it's in the sun. So, and those tests are quite crucial. And it takes quite a while to get the pitch exactly the way you want it to go on the canoe. And I always carry a pitch
bucket. So my next question is, how do you test it? What's the test?
Well, after you're going to heat it up and not boil it. If you boil it, it turns black. And you just heat it up enough to melt it and then put the animal fat in it, usually 20% animal fat, and then just a pinch of wood ash, which tempers it a little bit. And then once you've got that all melted together, you take a stick and put the stick in the bucket, and you take the stick and raise it above your head, and you're going to have a bead or the stream of pitch. And if it doesn't break, it's ready. And even in a slight breeze, it'll bend. There'll be a slight bend in it. You know it's all ready. But if it breaks, it's not ready yet. You put a little bit more pitch in it, or put a little bit more animal fat in it, right? And then the second test is you take a piece of birch bark, dip it into the pitch, and then blow on it or stick it in water, let it cool, and then bend the bark. And if the pitch breaks, it's no good, because it's gonna shatter in the cold. And then you put your hand over it to heat it up. And if it doesn't become sticky or run, you know it's good. And if it's not, you got to put some more pitch in
fat in. That must be quite a process.
It takes a while. That's why I say when I do it, I make a lot. And I always carry that extra in the pitch pail, so forth, and always in the canoe, and so that you can repair your canoe.
Who says we're not chemists, sir?
And in modern day transportation, you pitch the canoe, getting ready to use, and then you throw it on top of your pickup truck to transport it somewhere, and because you've got it tied down and the pickup is moving, it's racking, and it always opens up the cracks, the seams, the pitch cracks, and so forth. So you always have to repitch it before you put it in the water. So there's a lot of work to keep it good.
I remember you telling me, James, about a canoe that kind of, would you say, blew up. What happened with that?
So we have a. Actually, the canoe that's at Epic Sports currently is affectionately called the First Third Canoe. So it was the first canoe that was constructed, and it was in one of our meeting rooms at the tribe, and it was February, and it was nice and cozy in that heated room, and a tribal member was taking the canoe to a boat show in February, and he took it outside and he put it on his car and he strapped it to his car, and the whole side just blew out. And so we finished the second canoe, which is the one that's at the Bangor Mall, and then took all the pieces from the first canoe and found a new piece of bark and rebuilt it. So that's the first third story. We won't mention any names.
Well, the reason it did that, the bark has resin in it. That's why you heat it up in order to make it pliable, so that you can bend it and shape it and so forth. And that resin, when it was in the warm room, was very fluid and supple. And he took it out. It was below zero that particular day. And that resin just all of a sudden, you know, became cold and had nowhere to go, and then it ruptured that bark. And that was the first canoe that we built on Indian Island.
Wow. You know who you are out there.
So, you know, we see these stories all the time in the news about these older canoes. And, you know, one older canoe that we won't see in the flotilla, but it is at the Penobscot Nation Museum, is a canoe that was made by Joe Polis. And when Joe Polis was paddling with Thoreau at the end of that journey, they make their way to Indian Island, and Polis is trying to sell him the canoe. And so they go into some detail about the length and, you know, the measurements of the canoe, and which happen to be the exact measurements of the Polis canoe that we have at the Indian Island Museum. So we think it's the exact canoe that he took Thoreau on in 1857.
Hmm. Wow. Oh, incidentally, the first canoe that I built was a 14-footer. I'd built a lot of scale model ones before that, and then I attempted to build the big one, the 14-foot. And I went to the museum, and I took all the measurements off in that canoe, and the measurements of my canoe are exact to that particular one.
Wow. You still have that canoe that you...
Oh, yeah, it's a 14-footer that I built, and I wanted to do it entirely myself. I gathered all the materials myself in the forest. And I split them, and I shaped them and everything, and I built the canoe entirely myself. And I wanted to do that when I'm building the first one. And the second one was an 18-footer, and two of my sons wanted to build a family canoe. So we built an 18-footer. And, that's a beautiful canoe as well.
So what about cedar? I see cedar canoes around quite a bit.
Like these cedar-stripped canoes?
Yeah, you see these
cedar-strip.
Yeah, with the ribs in them and all mm-hmm. of that, yeah. Yeah, this...
Have you done those, or...?
I haven't. My brother Neil has built numerous... strip canoes. Matter of fact, there's still a couple in the state, 28-foot war canoes.
Wow!
And then he built a 28-footer that 13 of us Penobscots took to the Yukon River in Alaska, and we paddled 400 miles up the Yukon River in that particular canoe that he built, and that was a cedar strip. They're very very popular today. And but they're unlike the birchback canoe. They're built similar to the canvas canoe. Whereas the birchback canoe, you form the bark first, and then you put the plank in and the ribs in last. Whereas the canvas canoe or the strip canoe, you have a form. And you put the planking on and the ribs on first, and then the planking on it, and then you put the covering on it. So it's the birchback canoe is done totally different.
So do you use cedar at all in the structure of the?
Oh yeah, it's very very important part of the canoe. The entire inside of the canoe, the planking is all cedar, anywhere from an inch wide to 3 inches wide and, you know, like an eighth of an inch thick or even thinner in some cases. And that is all held in place by the ribs made out of cedar, which you shape and bend by hand and let them dry. And when you put those ribs in, they're actually pounded into place. They're jammed up underneath the gunwale, and it holds the planking in place. And there's probably somewhere in the order of 45 to 50 ribs in a 18-foot canoe. And if you took the ribs out of the canoe, the entire inside planking would fall out because there's no glue, there's no nails. It's all held in place by pressure.
Wow. So how much, you said you use spruce gum or...
Yes, pitch, yeah.
Pitch. How much of that do you actually use when you construct the canoe?
Well,
do you use any of it? I mean...
Yes. When you form the bark, before you put the insides and put the planking in, you waterproof the seams, which you've sewn, first. Then you put the planking in. Right? And that... Because you're going to have waterproofing inside and out. After you get the canoe completely constructed with the ribs in it and everything, you have the seams which is in the back, and on the ends, which are sown by spruce root. Those all have to be covered by pitch, the spruce pitch, and the moose fat I was telling you about. So that's the waterproofing, and without it, those seams would and the ends would leak. So it's a very important part of the construction.
So how long does it take to make? I know it probably varies, but
I've been asked that question many times, and the last one we built, that 18-footer a couple of years ago, I kept track of the actual construction of the canoe from the time we unrolled the bark. And if the three of us worked, let's say, 4 hours on it, you know, I'd put down 12 hours. If I worked on myself, I'd put down those hours. Anyway, construction from start to finish was about 185 hours of actually putting the thing together. That does not include all the shaping of the planking and the ribs with a crooked knife, all by hand, numerous hours. And that does not include the gathering of the bark, which you spend days and days looking for. And you spend days and days looking for cedar trees that are tall and straight and no limbs. And then you spend a day digging the spruce root, gathering
now,
the pitch.
That spruce root, Butch. What? Now, James was explaining a little bit about that, how it's like it goes out horizontally,
that's
sort
right.
of, in the ground. It's not. It doesn't go deep down.
That's right.
So it's sort of like a spidery kind of going out.
Exactly.
And it's tough.
It is.
Yeah.
You have big roots, of course, in the tree, you know, 4 to 6 inches. But you also have the small ones. And you dig next to the trunk of the tree. And this is usually in an area that's wet, as mossy as the best. And you find a piece of spruce root that's the size of your thumb, let's say, and then you cut it off and start pulling it up, walking back away from the tree, and if it goes under another root, you pull it underneath, dig it out and pull it underneath, and I've walked back away from the tree, you know, for 15 or 16 feet,
wow.
A piece of root that long, and the beauty of the spruce root, another beauty of it, is that it holds its diameter for most of its length. So that you take in a 16-foot piece of spruce root, it maintains its diameter for most of that. And it's very flexible. Then you roll it up and bring it home, and then you have to take the bark off it and split it and split it and split it to get it down to where you want it. Very versatile.
Hmm.
And they also use it in making other baskets as well.
The birch bark baskets?
Yes.
Yeah. Any comments, James?
Well, I've seen, these canoes mate quite a bit. And, you know, unfortunately, as the tribe's historian, I'm always taking pictures and I've never really participated in making them, but have photographed all of them being built. And I can't help to notice that there's because of all the carving that goes on, there's a ton of, like, cedar shavings, like, on the ground. Is there something special you do with some of that?
Well, first of all, it makes great fire starters. But in the bow and the stern of the canoe, we actually stuff them with those shavings because the bow and the stern does not have any ribs, so there's no support in there. And so behind the what we call the faceboard, we stuff it with shavings. And then put the faceboard in, and that not only gives it buoyancy, but supports the bark, keeps the shape of the bark from collapsing. And there's a small deck on each end of the canoe, which keeps the splashes of the waves off in those shavings. However, if they get wet, you can snap that headboard out and replace the shavings. It's not easy to do, but you can do it and put fresh shavings in. And you generate a lot of shavings when you carve in ribs and planking and the gunnels. A lot of shavings.
Well, could put them in your closet, right?
You could, yeah. But people take bags from home just for the fire starters. They're great.
I noticed in almost all the canoes, the center thwart of the canoe is not like the others. It has...
what do you mean?
Well, the cross pieces from side to side, you know, the bracing in the canoe. They're called thwarts. Gunnels are the kind of around the outside, and these thwarts crisscross across the canoe. And the center thwart has a shape to it.
That's right.
What is that for?
The center thwart has I guess you'd call them notches on each end. Let's say about 20% of the thwart from the gunwale there's a notch, and that's to put a tump line. You make a take the basswood tree, and you braid it. And you make a rope, and then you tie that onto that center thwart. When you put your canoe on your shoulders, you take that tump line and put it around your forehead, and it balances the canoe. So you can use one hand or both hands to carry stuff, and that tump line keeps the canoe balanced because it's exactly in the middle. It's sitting on your shoulders, but that tump line keeps it balanced with it's around your head. And the notches keep the tump line from slipping towards the middle, as it would without these notches.
Huh. Pretty amazing.
And incidentally, there's no seats in a birch bark canoe like you would a modern canoe, so that you have on each end your thwart, and it's just a piece of ash like the other thwarts, and you kneel. In the canoe with your butt against the thwart, and that's how you paddle.
Interesting. Great. Okay. You've been listening to WERU, Abenaki Windows. We've been talking about the history and the building of birch bark canoes. And my guest is James Francis, tribal historian and director of the Penobscot Nation Cultural Center and Penobscot Elder Butch Phillips. Thank you for joining us, and join us again next month for another Wabanaki Windows. The music for our shows is by Rolf Richter, a track called Little Eagles from his CD Dreamwalk. Thank you.